Hey, welcome to the Beginner Photography Podcast, brought to you by CloudSpot, the easiest way to deliver and sell your photos online. I'm your host, Raymond Hatfield, and today is a new series. It is a monthly Q&A episode. So I know that you have questions about photography, and I want to answer them for you. You know, whenever you have a question about photography, whether it's day or night, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you can head over to beginnerphotopod.com/QA. Again, that's beginnerphotopod.com/QA, and you can send me your questions. You know, after shooting for more than a decade and interviewing 300 plus world-class photographers, I figured it is time to share some of that practical information with you, the listeners. So with that, why don't we just go ahead and dive into this week's questions? So the first question actually comes from Shane and his dog. Let's go ahead and hear from Shane.
Hey, Raymond and BPP listener, Shane Wilkie here. Got two questions today. First one being, Raymond, I was wondering if you could speak a little bit on white balance. I'm just starting to get into using flash when I shoot indoors a lot now, and white balance can be a trouble. What are the chances you can hear my dog clicking around in the background here? He's going to make an appearance in every voice note now. Okay, so anyways, what white balance to use and when in under indoor lighting? And question for you, Raymond, if you could do anything one day with photography, like you could shoot anything, say, and just you had 1 hour to do it, what would you go shoot and what format would you use and why? All right, thanks. Have a great day. Love all the new content. And I don't think I included this in my last voice note, but I wish you the very best in your new journey with video. All right, peace.
Geez, thanks, Shane. You and your dog are going to become a regular on these Q&A episodes. This is going to be wonderful. Okay, let's tackle those questions, right? So white balance and flash indoors. So I'll tackle this two ways because I know that you are also shooting film now. So if you are shooting on film, you probably know this, but many listeners might not. If you're shooting on film, you can't choose your white balance. Your white balance is predicated on which film you use. And there are two options. You either shoot with daylight balanced film, meaning you're going to shoot photos outside, or you shoot with tungsten balanced film. And that means you're going to be shooting inside. Now, there are many different other situations that you might find yourself in requiring a different white balance. And that's why there was lots of color correcting filters in the film days. Digital, not so much, because you can change your white balance within camera, and then all that color information is saved in the raw file. So you can actually change your white balance after you take the photo with digital, as long as you're shooting in raw. So like me, I know that you like to get it right in camera. So that, again, begs the question, which white balance should you use when shooting indoors with flash? So flash, all flashes, all speed lights are set to 5,500 degrees Kelvin. Now, what that means is that the light coming out of a speed light is balanced for daylight. So that you can actually take it outdoors, use a speed light, and it's going to be the same color temperature as the sun, right? Sunlight. And that's great because when you're outdoors, you need a lot of power to come out of your flash to be able to overpower the sun, right? Or at least try to equal the sun's power. And that's why it's set to daylight. Now, when you go indoors, right? Now we're getting back to your question here. When you go indoors, you really have two options. One, you could either set the white balance on your camera for daylight because you're going to be using flash and the flash is going to be illuminating your subject, and you want your subject to look color accurate, so you can set your white balance on your camera for daylight, and they're going to look great. But what this means is that everything else in the background, if there's just like tungsten bulbs because you're indoors, they're going to look super warm, like orange, right? So the way that you can compensate for this is that you could set your white balance on your camera for tungsten or indoor light, and then you would match, you would match the color of the interior lights by putting what's called a CTO gel on your flash. CTO stands for color temperature orange. You're changing the color temperature from daylight to orange, right? Which is more tungsten. That way, when you take a photo, everything from your subject to all the lights in your background will appear to be the same color balance. Now, this is great if that's what you're going for. But again, if you're looking for more of a creative look, more of a look that you wouldn't naturally see with your eyes, I would set my camera, and this is what I do at weddings. I set my, I take that back. What I do at weddings, like during a reception, is that I will gel my light with CTO so that the light coming out of my flash is orange, but I'll use my off-camera flash like in a corner with no gel on it. So when I set my color temperature or my white balance for tungsten, the person in front of me looks, you know, the proper color, but the light coming from my off-camera flash is super blue. And I think that it just adds an extra layer of dimension into my photos. And again, this is why it is just so great to be able to use flash, because you can manipulate light and you can really get exactly what you're looking for. So once again, to fully answer your question, when you're shooting indoors with flash, you can use daylight balanced or daylight white balance, and your subject will be in proper color. I hope that helps. All right. Part two of your question is, if I had a, like, what is a bucket list photo that I would, you know, want if I had an hour and I could do anything, right? If that's the question that you're asking, that answer changes from day to day, from hour to hour. I come to realize that, I love two things. I love something that is really unique, and I love something with access, right? So when I think about some of my favorite photos, you know, it is from photojournalists. They have access because they have a press badge, and they're shooting something unique because, well, it's newsworthy, right? And I think recently, okay, so long story short. When I was in sixth and seventh grade, growing up in California, we got to spend a week in Yosemite for a school trip. And that was just, I mean, that transformed my life. It was honestly the most beautiful place I had ever been, ever. And I still think about that to this day, even though it was more than half my life ago, right? Years, 20 plus years ago. So I still think about Yosemite quite often. And then when I, Pete Souza, who I had on the podcast not too long ago, who was the chief White House photographer under the Reagan and Obama administration, has a photo where I guess President Obama came to visit Yosemite, and he was in the helicopter before the president. So he landed before the president and he ran to the spot. And in Yosemite, if you haven't been, if you don't know, there's a rock formation called Half Dome. And I mean, it is just awe inspiring when you see it in the morning and it's being lit. And, you know, the light hasn't reached down into the valley yet. It is just amazing. And he has this photo of Marine One, which is the helicopter that the president was in, landing. And it's silhouetted. It's a silhouette of the helicopter with Half Dome in the background. Like, it's taking up all of Half Dome, right? The Half Dome it's a full frame of the photo. And then Marine One is in the foreground, but it's silhouetted. And it is absolutely just an amazing photo because of the timing, right? And the access, right? Nobody else can take that photo because Pete Souza had the access to work with the president, and the timing, because like he was able to plan that out, and like he got in the right place at the right time. He knew what was going to happen. And that to me makes that like an amazing photo. Otherwise, it's just a helicopter and a rock. You know what I mean? So like what really makes that photo different is the access and the timing, which I just absolutely, absolutely love. So, to answer your question, if I had an hour, like today, my answer would be, if I had an hour, I would spend it in Yosemite about this time where there's a little bit of snow on the ground, but not a ton, right? Nothing's blanketed. It's just more dusted with some snow. And there would be a nice trail in the foreground. There'd be a stream. Maybe that would be the focus of the shot, right? The stream coming down in the middle of the photo. And then in the background would be Half Dome, because it is just so iconic and so beautiful. And it would be being lit by it'd be an early morning photo, and it would just be getting just annihilated with that beautiful orange red sunrise light. Ugh, gorgeous. I can think of it in my head. But again, you know, that shot means something to me because the timing, right? you got to get it right. And you have to have the access to be able to get into a spot, because a lot of it is, you know, blocked off. You're not allowed to go off trails. So like to get that shot requires access and timing, and timing, because moment matters most, right? So I hope that helps. That answer might change here in an hour or two, you know, but who knows? That's what my answer is right now. So I hope that helps. All right. Now we are going to answer Ryan's question. Ryan sent in a voicemail as well. So let's hear what Ryan asks.
Hello, Raymond. I just started listening to your podcast today, the day that I'm recording this. I'm heading up to college right now. It's about an 8-hour drive, and I needed something to listen to. And I'm a photography major, so I was like, photography, sure. But I'm so glad that I turned it on. Your podcasts are amazing, and one of my favorite things that you said was, photography is all about the story. And that is such a relief to hear, because I agree completely. So many people will tell you it's about the lighting, it's about the composition, it's about the camera, yada, yada, yada. But all of those are just tools that help you tell your story. So when you said that today, it made my heart happy, because I don't hear that from a lot of photographers. So that was awesome. My question for you today is, how do you go about planning and telling your story when you go on a shoot? Is it something that you plan ahead of time and you know going in, this is the story that I want to tell with this shoot? Or is it something that you decide in the moment, like in this particular picture, this is the story that I want to come across? How do you go about doing that? What is your process? Thank you.
If you're ready to turn your lens towards a profitable future, but are unsure how to stand out in a competitive market, well, then I've got just the solution for you. I'm thrilled to offer you exclusive access to our free video training called Maximizing Mini Sessions. It's put on by the legendary duo Philip and Eileen Bloom. This video webinar is designed specifically for photographers like you who are eager to learn the art of effective marketing and promotion, and who want to start earning money with your camera. This isn't about just taking great photos. It's about making sure the right people see them. Discover the power of mini sessions, the secret of promoting them, not just to get noticed, but to truly stand out. Learn the best timing and tactics to catch your audience's eye and get them in front of the camera. So if marketing has been your stumbling block, then wait no more. Visit beginnerphotopod.com/mini to sign up for your free video training now. It's time to put your photography in the spotlight where it belongs. Wow. Ryan, first of all, welcome. Welcome to the community of Beginner Photography Podcast listeners. You have now been officially indoctrinated in. Very cool that you're going off to school to learn photography. I wish that I did that. I wish that I went to school to learn photography sometimes, rather than going to film school to learn, motion film. And that's one reason why I started the podcast, was because I felt kind of like an imposter and I wanted to go out and, you know, talk to accomplished photographers and hear how it is that they saw the world. The gear I could figure out, because like you said, gear is just a tool. It's going to change, but it doesn't really change like the photo. You can look at photos from the 80s, from the 60s, and think, wow, this is a really powerful photo. And your question isn't, oh man, I wonder what camera they used. But yet for some reason we do that today, which is, I don't know. I can't stand that. I can't understand it. I'm still trying to figure out why we do that. Like, what changed? But anyway, it doesn't matter. To answer your question, Ryan, which is, how do I plan the story before a shoot? Do I plan ahead, or does it just kind of come up in the moment? Primarily, I'll answer this two ways, right? So primarily as a wedding photographer, how I approach those images would be different than how I just capture like my family and whatnot. So as a wedding photographer, I know the story. It's two people, they're joining their lives together in front of all their family and friends, right? That's the big story. But then within that, I have to tell smaller stories. The story of, you know, a bride reading a letter from her dad, saying, you know, I'm so proud of the girl that you have become, you know, the woman that you have become. The story of, the groom and his, you know, best friends being surrounded by them and, you know, they possibly saw all the crazy relationships that he was in growing up, and now they're there to support him in this new one that he's in. The story of parents, the story of friends, the story of, you know, people who matter the most to this couple here. And that happens within the photo. And it really happens depending on what's happening in front of me. You know, I try to look around with my bare eyes as much as I can, see what's happening, and then whatever looks interesting or I can tell is important, I'll go capture that. But you got to ask yourself, like, what's the subject here? Like, what's the story that's going on here? You know, there are times where, you know, maybe during a reception, a friend comes up to the bride or groom or whatever, and they're just like, typically the bride, and they'll just be like bawling their eyes out, you know, oh, I'm so happy for you. Like, this is such a beautiful wedding day, you know, things like that. And that's not the bride's story. That's a story for the bride, but that's that guest's story right there, because they are just spilling their heart out. They could have said this the entire year leading up to the wedding, but they didn't. They waited until that day to be face to face with the bride. And that means something. Like, that is a powerful moment. So I think about the story in that sense. Who's the subject? Well, it's the guest. It's not the bride. So who am I going to focus on? I'm going to focus on that guest. What do I want to see? I just want to see them blubbering and just like gripping onto the bride and just saying, you know, like, you are so beautiful, you know, all of these things, because that's what that story is. But it would be different if, you know, the, say, the ring bearer was walking down the aisle and, you know, ring bearers are typically pretty young kids, and maybe they get scared or nervous or whatever, and they just start running down the aisle because they're like, oh, actually, I don't like this. And then they just start sprinting, like, you know, where's my mom? I just want to get into her hands or something. And that's an entirely different story. First of all, now I don't have the access to just go wherever I want to and like circle this kid and get the perfect shot. I pretty much have to be at the mercy of what's happening during the reception. So I'm kind of limited in that way, but I still try to figure out, what is that story? It's the kid freaking out. But what else is happening? Everybody else is kind of laughing. Like, oh, this is so cute. So I'm going to try to get a close up of that kid, like, oh, I don't like this. And then also a wide of the kid, maybe running down the aisle, but wide enough to see, you know, people, guests of the wedding laughing and, you know, stuff like that. So like, it really is looking at the big picture. What is the story? But then asking yourself with every photo that you take, okay, what is the smaller story right here that I can fully tell within an image, right? That's always my goal. But when I'm photographing my family, it's still kind of the same, to where I know that like the big picture image is, I want to capture photos of my kids growing up, right? So like their childhood is important to me, and I know that it's going to be important to them. So that's the story. What was their childhood like? But then within that, this is more of a long-term series of photos. You ask, what's happening? You know, what are these milestones as a child? It could literally be a birthday party. Like, that's the milestone. You're now a year older. Or it can be something smaller, just like playing in the sprinklers with the neighbors, because that's what you did as a kid, you know. So it's just trying to figure out what are those stories that you want to tell, and then how do you best tell those stories through composition, light, framing, and moment, obviously. So Ryan, I hope that helped. Again, good luck in school. Don't be a stranger. You know, come join the community over at beginnerphotopod.com/group. We'd love to have you in there and continue the conversation. I'd love to see, you know, your progression as a photographer while you go through school and some of your experiences as well. So again, Ryan, thank you. All right, next we have actually this question that I got, I saw from Kim in the group, who she posted it in the group. She didn't reach out to me specifically. She didn't send in a voicemail or whatever. But I thought that this question was so important, especially for this time of the year being winter, that I want to answer it here, right? So Kim asks, what do you all do to stay active with your photography in the winter? I believe that she said, you know, it's hard to find motivation with personal work, and also like professional work kind of dries up, because who wants to go outside and take photos? And Kim, you are absolutely right. I feel the exact same way. You know, I love being outdoor. I love shooting more reactionary photos, especially of my kids, right? Like, what's happening right now? And then I'm going to capture that to the best of my ability. But in the wintertime, we're not doing as many activities, so that limits how many photos I'm actually taking. And I think after years of trying to fight this as much as I can, trying to find activities for our family to do, just to go out, or, you know, find something to occupy my time. I think it's really important to understand that sometimes staying afloat is enough. You know, sometimes you don't capture a magical photo for 2 months, 3 months, and you got to be okay with that, because you know that warmer months are coming. But right now, it's not. So if you don't feel motivated, there's kind of the two schools of thought. You just work yourself through it. Like, what is the, I think Stephen King said, what was it? I could be totally wrong in who said this and what was said, but it was something like, construction workers don't have construction block. You know, like, they show up to work and they do work every day, you know, but we as creatives almost use writer's block, or, I don't know, idea block, photographer's block, whatever you want to call it, as like an excuse rather than pushing through it. So again, the two schools of thought are like, you know, what do you do best in? For me, forcing a photo sometimes can kickstart that motivation, but other times it just feels like a waste of time, and it can get me down even more than what I was feeling before when I, you know, tried to bump start this feeling of photography and this desire to go out and shoot. So it really is trying to figure out what it is that you want to do. It sounds to me like you do want to go out and shoot, and that's why you're asking this question. Otherwise, you would just be okay with having some time off, I guess, in photography. So try to figure out, you know, even though you may not have the same events or projects or whatever going on right now, there are some things that I'm sure that you like about the winter. Try to figure out what those things are and maybe just capture those. You know, maybe it's, you know, this is a very romantic idea here, but like, you know, curling up by the fire with a cup of, you know, hot chocolate and a book, or, you know, something like that. Figure out what those elements are that you do like about winter and just photograph those. And even if they're just to keep you staying afloat, that's enough. I hope that helps, Kim. All right. Next, we have another voicemail from Bill here. So let's hear Bill's voicemail.
Hi, Raymond. My name is Bill, and I live in Florida. I've been enjoying your podcast, and I shoot with a Fuji X-T4. I do have a question. Do you use auto ISO? If not, why? And if you do, how do you set it up? Thanks.
Are you ready to transform your love for photography into profit? Imagine capturing beautiful moments while bringing in a little extra money for your family each month. Sound too good to be true? With CloudSpot, it's not just a dream. Designed by photographers for photographers, CloudSpot simplifies your business. Effortlessly organize shoots, send professional contracts, questionnaires, invoices, and enjoy faster payment payouts with the lowest fees in the industry, including PayPal. Forget lost emails and messy spreadsheets. CloudSpot offers a streamlined workflow, letting you focus on the moment. And here is the clincher. Grab your free CloudSpot account at deliverphotos.com, and you'll get access to my personal wedding and portrait contracts and questionnaires. So don't let uncertainty hold you back. Embrace the future of photography business management with CloudSpot Studio. Sign up at deliverphotos.com today and transform your passion into profit. All right, Bill, first of all, you probably don't have the same issues as Kim does about having a lack of motivation in the winter down there in Florida. But to get to your question, X-T4, great camera, phenomenal camera. I own the camera. I like the camera. As far as the auto ISO goes, I don't use it for a few reasons. And maybe they're just antiquated reasons, you know. There was never auto ISO on film, because your ISO or ASA on film was predicated by the film stock that you used, and then you had to work within that. And personally, I kind of like working within some sort of restraint. Even though today I can change my ISO on a whim, I like having that control of knowing that my camera is going to capture exactly what I want it to capture, and that there's no confusion, right? It's more reliable to shoot with full manual settings, because your settings aren't going to change. They're going to be exactly what they are. What is going to change is the light, people, the moment, things like that. But what's not going to change is your camera settings. And I just have this feeling that when your camera makes the decisions on what your exposure should be, it just feels like, I don't want to say cheating, because cheating is not the right term, but it just doesn't feel like, from my perspective, that I fully created that image. Now, you know, on the same token, though, I mean, I've taken some photos that I'm really proud of on my iPhone, and the only thing that I'm controlling there is the composition, the frame, and the moment, you know, and it takes care of the exposure. But it's like when I have the X-T4 in my hand, it's a phenomenal camera. I want to know that it's going to capture exactly what I want to capture, exactly how I want it to capture, and therefore, I don't really use auto ISO. Yeah, I wish that I could help you more with that. I know a lot of people who love auto ISO. I would say it's just that in my experience, now this was years ago, I haven't really given it a shot since, but there was just very inconsistent results. You know, sometimes the camera would choose settings like, you know, F8, but then, you know, bump up the ISO to 3200, but like, it's kind of sunny outside. So like, why would the camera decide to do something like that? But if you are choosing your own aperture and your own shutter speed, I don't know why aperture and shutter speed would be so important that they have to be locked, but ISO could be varied. I would much rather have, I mean, again, depending on what you're shooting, my ISO locked and my aperture locked, and then let my shutter speed kind of, you know, have some movement to it, figure out where it wants to go, because, you know, it's going to be less likely to screw you up, right? If you have a photo taken at 1/8000th of a second of a shutter speed, it's going to, depending on what you're shooting, pretty much going to look the same as if you shot it at 1/250th of a second. The image quality will be, but the difference between, you know, ISO 100 and ISO 1600, which isn't even as big of a exposure gap as the 1/250th of a second shutter speed and the 1/8000th of a second shutter speed, it's going to be a massive difference in your photography. So for those reasons, I just don't use ISO. I like to be able to control my camera, have full control, and shoot in full manual. The only thing that I really allow my camera to decide is, and it's not even decide, but it's to control somewhat, is the focus, is the autofocus, because it's just going to do a way better and way more accurate job than I could ever do in manual focus. And if I can still control where I want the camera to focus, then it's still giving me that control that I desire. So, Bill, I hope that helped answer your question. I wish that it could, you know, be more helpful and teach you how to set it up. But honestly, I just don't know any situations that I would like to be in to give up that control of my exposure. All right. Next question that we got here is from Mark. Mark sent me this email. He says, hey, Raymond, I am a beginner. I just want to take some great pics, even if it's on auto, on vacations, etc., landscapes, you know, whatever, but I need a zoom for close-ups. We were in Yellowstone, and my iPhone was great until there was a bear about a quarter mile away, and my pics of it just looked like a black blob, not a bear. I get that. So I've heard about a super zoom camera, kind of an all-purpose single lens that can do it all. Does such a thing exist? Can you buy one for less than $500? Less than $250? What would you recommend? Well, Mark, first of all, welcome. You know, you're in the right spot. Podcast is called the Beginner Photography Podcast. You came to the right place. To answer your question, I fully understand how frustrating it is to not be able to get close enough to something. And you immediately go into this mode of like, well, what gear can I buy that can solve this problem? The first question that I would ask myself, yourself, is how often would you really use that, right? How often are you going to Yellowstone and trying to shoot something a quarter mile away? If it's not often, I don't know if it's worth it, right? I mean, you said, you know, maybe $500, $250. Okay, I could see that, you know, might be worth it. But the answer is no. Like, there's not anything for less than $500 or $250 that's going to give you what it is that you need. So let me tell you why. There is a class of cameras called super zooms. there's not really lenses that are super zooms. And again, here's why. So this camera that's a super zoom, I'm going to use for reference. I had to Google, you know, what are some recent super zooms? And it looks like the most recent one is called the Nikon P1000. Now, this camera has a focal range of 24 millimeters, nice and wide, all the way to 3,000 millimeters. That's a 125 times zoom, which is insane. Really crazy, right? Seems like a do-it-all, exactly what you need type photo. But that is only possible because it has a teeny tiny sensor inside. The amount of movement that the glass has to make to be able to reach, you know, 3,000 millimeters is such a tiny image circle through the lens that the sensor has to be teeny, teeny, tiny. A DSLR has a large image sensor. And when you take into account something like a, you know, one of the most popular telephoto lenses for a DSLR, it costs $2,500, sometimes more, and it's a 70mm to 200mm. That's only 2.5 times zoom, right? So having a 125 times zoom is just insane. And the reason why the 70 to 200 only has a 2.5 times zoom is because DSLRs and mirrorless cameras have such large sensors that the size of the zoom that you would need for a 24 millimeter to 3000 millimeter lens, I mean, it would be bigger than a bus. Like, it just has to be, because the amount of light that has to come in at that point shrinks when you zoom in, right? So the longer the focal length. So in short, it's not possible to get some sort of all-in-one lens. They do make something, they make an 18 to 200 millimeter lens, which that is considered a slow lens. It doesn't let in a lot of light, and there's a lot of limitations with it. But even that is only a 10 times zoom. And 200 millimeters really isn't as far as you think that it is. It's definitely not going to, you know, reach a quarter of a mile away. So, you know, if you really wanted something that was kind of like an all-around, you know, all-purpose camera, and you're okay with giving up the controls, like you said, you know, you just want to get some good photos, even if you're in auto, I would say that Nikon P1000 looks like a really good choice. Image quality looks to be good. You know, obviously the focal length, 24 to 3000, is just insane to think about. You could literally shoot the moon. That's crazy. But it is $1,000. So even with a tiny sensor, such an incredible lens like that is still going to be pretty pricey. You might be able to find some older generation super zoom type cameras, but the low light performance is going to be very lacking, and you're going to have to be shooting in, I mean, broad daylight to be able to get a good photo. So I hope that helped, Mark. And if you have any more questions, feel free to let me know. But I'd say that getting a dedicated super zoom camera would probably be your best bet if shooting things a quarter of a mile away is going to be something that you're going to do somewhat often. All right, next we got a question from Joe. Joe sent me this email as well. He said, "Hey, Raymond, what late model camera is more geared towards photography than video would you recommend for shooting wildlife?" Well, Joe, great question. And I think that you have the right direction, right? You want a camera that's more focused towards photography than video. You know, here's the thing, is that we kind of have gotten ourselves to a place to where it is, you can add, you know, features from both a stills camera and a video camera into one and have a very decent camera that or a very good camera that's decent at both of those. So I wouldn't say that there's really a camera that's more geared just towards photography than video, especially for wildlife. But I would say that there are still some great cameras out there that will do you just fine. So the thing with shooting wildlife is kind of like what Mark was saying earlier, like you don't want to get much closer than a quarter of a mile to a bear. Well, maybe you do, but I don't. Like, I would only want to be about a quarter of a mile away to be able to photograph a bear. And to his point also, the reason why that super zoom camera has such a tiny sensor is because you need a very large image circle to be able to zoom in very far, right? So in that sense, getting something like a full frame camera is actually advantageous to being able to shoot wildlife photography. You want a crop sensor camera because it's going to give you an additional reach because the photo is going to be cropped in a bit while still giving you the same full resolution, you know, 30 24, 30, 36 megapixels or whatever it is, and still delivering great image quality. So right now, I would say that the best camera for that job is probably the Canon R7. I've never shot with this camera. I've never held this camera. But just my knowledge of cameras and looking at the specifications, it looks really well suited to be shooting wildlife. One, it has a crop sensor camera, or it has a crop sensor inside, giving you that additional reach that is good for wildlife, letting you get closer to wildlife without scaring them away or whatnot. It's also their new mirrorless system, so it's going to have a little bit of future-proofing involved. Autofocus is great, but the only issue that I see with it is that there's not really a lot of telephoto lenses geared towards it that are really good, right? I think there's an 800 millimeter f11 lens, which if all you're shooting is wildlife and you know that everything that you're shooting is a good distance away, I mean, that's going to be a great lens, but it's not a multi-purpose lens at all. Like, that's all that you're going to be using it for. If the Canon R7 is not something that, you know, maybe you already have a DSLR and you already have some lenses, and you're still looking for a great camera at a great price, I would say the older traditional DSLR, their Canon 7D Mark II, 7D as in Delta Mark II. That camera is a professional grade crop sensor camera made for things like wildlife photography. And it also has things like, you know, wonderful dual pixel autofocus and dual card slots. So if, you know, making money from your wildlife photos was something that you do and having redundancy in your images is important, then the 7D Mark II has you covered. And those can be had for just a couple of $100, not much at all these days. As far as the R7, I'm not sure if it has, you know, dual camera slots or anything like that. But if you're just photographing wildlife for fun or it's a hobby, one camera slot is going to do you just fine. I mean, people used to shoot on film. And if you got one frame wrong, like all 36 were bad, you know, and that's about as dangerous as it gets. So you're going to be fine with just one camera slot if you're not doing it in a professional setting. So again, the Canon R7, if you want a bit of a future-proofed camera, or the Canon 7D, as in Delta Mark II, if you want to save a bit of money but still have, you know, a wonderful camera for wildlife. So, Joe, I hope that helped. All right, we got one last question here, and it is from Darius, who sent in a voicemail. Let us hear from Darius.
Hey, thanks for taking my question. What are some ways of starting to do photography for a living other than taking portraits of people or weddings or private events? Thank you.
So, solid question, Darius. I get it. If you don't like working with people, why would you want to photograph them for money? That is a great question. Unfortunately, it is a very, very broad question, and there are a million answers. I know photographers who are commercial photographers who only photograph clear liquids, not colored liquids, not, you know, opaque liquids, clear liquids. We're talking vodka, we're talking water, we're talking Sprite, right? Like things like that, only clear liquids. And they make a great living at it because they're the best in the world at it. There are some photographers who make a living by, you know, going into shelters and photographing images of dogs and, you know, giving them to the shelter and then giving possibly a gift voucher when an animal is, what is the right word here? Adopted? I was going to say picked up, but that sounds wrong. When an animal is, you know, taken home, I guess, and they photograph animals, you know? So it really depends on kind of what is your lifestyle. Like, you got to figure out how much you need to live because that's going to change a lot. If you need a lot of money to live, you might just have to photograph people because people are probably going to pay the most. Commercial can pay a lot, but you're going to be working with people as well. But if you don't need a lot to live, like if you have very, what's the word I'm looking for? I'm at a total loss of words here. If you don't have a high standard of living, I guess, if you live very comfortably, then, you know, you can get away with shooting smaller gigs. again, I know of photographers who just go out and they photograph their town and local area. And then, you know, on Saturday afternoons or Saturday mornings, they go to a farmer's market and they sell their prints, and they don't make a lot of money, but it's enough for them, you know, and they're able to be a professional photographer earning enough money to, you know, not have a full-time job. So, but if you have the, you know, you got to have the new Mercedes, you got to have, you know, the fancy clothes, watches, you know, whatever it is, I don't know, I'm just making generalized comments here, then that's not going to be the way for you to go. But so the question that I would ask myself is like, what do I love? You know, what do I love doing? If you love spending time outside, if you love being in nature, you know, figure out how you can go that route, and then figure out, you know, depending on your means, are you going to be photographing shots to sell them at a farmer's market, or are you going to be making, you know, fine art prints and be selling them to hospitals and, you know, hotels and business centers and town halls and things like that, where they're going to be more willing to purchase an art installation, but it's going to be nowhere near the frequency of sales. So I wish that I could answer that question any better, but those are really the things that you need to figure out. What is it that you love, and how much do you need to survive? And then just reverse engineer how to do it. So Darius, again, I hope that helped and gave you some sort of direction as to being able to make it as a full-time photographer. Well, that is it today for our Q&A episode. If you listen to this and you thought to yourself, hey, wait a second, I have a photo question that I want to get answered on the show, all you got to do is head to beginnerphotopod.com/QA. Again, beginnerphotopod.com/QA to submit your question for the show. And remember, if you have a question about photography, chances are others do too. So by you asking your question, not only will you get the answer that you're looking for, but you will also be helping other photographers who are struggling with the exact same issue. So go ahead and give yourself a pat on the back for being so helpful. Again, if you have a question that you want answered, just head to beginnerphotopod.com/QA to send in your photo questions now. That is it for this week. Until next week, remember, the more that you shoot today, the better of a photographer you will be tomorrow. Talk soon.